Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, a report from Washington. One powerful U.S. senator wants to put the nation's nuclear waste in Nevada, regardless of whether people there want it or not. Should environmentalists be vegetarians? Large-scale production of meat is a huge industry, consuming resources and polluting waterways. But it can also be part of a sustainable system. We'll talk green about it. A portrait of lava falls on the Colorado River as we shoot the rapids. And in the Earth calendar, the Caribbean is awash in seaweed sex. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. The powerful chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, Republican Frank Murkowski from Alaska, has outlined his priorities for the coming year. First on his agenda is the contentious issue of storing our nation's nuclear waste. Congress has been struggling with this issue for years, but this is the first time legislation may actually get passed. Two House members say they'll introduce a bill in early April that calls for the construction of a temporary nuclear waste storage facility in Nevada. The interim site would be used while Congress decides whether to build a permanent storage facility at Nevada's Yucca Mountain. Senator Murkowski is sponsoring similar legislation in the Senate. Environment Show reporter Nancy Marshall recently sat down with the senator to get his views on the nuclear waste dilemma and other environmental issues. She filed this report from Washington.
The plan to locate the nation's nuclear waste at Nevada's Yucca Mountain has been criticized by a wide range of voices. They say the science supporting the idea is incomplete and the process of determining Yucca's suitability has been rushed. Senator Frank Murkowski, a Republican from Alaska, is brutally frank in responding to those protests and others from environmentalists and the Nevada congressional delegation.
When you're all through with all the smoke and mirrors, the bottom line is nobody wants this stuff. Okay, you can't throw it up in the air. It's going to come down somewhere. And I'm sensitive to the Nevada delegation and their objection to it, but still it's got to go somewhere. Why not put it in an area that's already basically so polluted by nuclear testing that it'll never be used for anything else?
Murkowski says that's the reasoning behind the idea for an interim storage facility in a part of Nevada that's been used for testing nuclear devices for years. The facility is intended to function temporarily while Yucca Mountain is completed. Murkowski's Energy and Natural Resources Committee has already passed legislation authorizing the temporary site. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott has said he wants to bring the measure before the full Senate for a vote soon. The bill is scheduled to be introduced in the House April 8th. But the legislation faces an uphill battle in both houses. President Clinton has promised to veto it, and so far the Senate is 10 shy of the votes needed to override a veto. But Murkowski is determined to see the bill become law. He says the nation's nuclear power plants are running out of space to store their nuclear waste, and it's unfair to delay the process.
The federal government entered into a contractual commitment many years ago to take this fuel by the year 1998. The ratepayers have contributed to the federal government about $12 billion. 1998 is right around the corner. The federal government has no capacity to take this waste.
Murkowski is a bit more flexible on other issues his committee is dealing with during this session of Congress. He says he is willing to consider reform of the 1872 Mining Act. President Clinton wants to increase the royalties companies pay for extracting oil, coal, minerals, and other natural resources out of land owned by the federal government. Murkowski says he might be open to an increase in royalties, but stresses that not all extraction industries should be treated the same.
Everybody says, well, you know, minerals are just like oil, gas, coal, where they come out of the ground and they have an immediate value. You can take a cup of oil, you can burn it, sell it, whatever. You can take a piece of coal, you can burn it, gas, a unit of gas has value. But you take a piece of ore You can use it as a doorstop. It has absolutely no value until it's refined.
Murkowski won't say what kind of an increase in royalty fees he would support, but stresses he is open to compromise with the White House. Murkowski is less flexible when asked about legislation that would allow some private sponsorship for national parks. The measure failed last year amid accusations that corporations would have been allowed to commercialize the parks. Murkowski accuses President Clinton of proposing a corporate sponsorship program, which Murkowski supported, then backing away from it when it was criticized. He says Clinton left him hanging.
Well, that's obvious, but I'm not picking a fight because we're going to try this process again. And I met with the Secretary of the Interior, and we've had discussions with various members, and they admit that, okay, we've got to come up with something here. I simply say until somebody comes up with a better idea of how we're going to pick up this funding, then I'm going with our program again, which was to provide, and we were working through the National Park Foundation to craft legislation again, attempt to get the administration on board and put them in a position if they don't want to support, okay, come up with an idea that will meet the exposure and the responsibility we have.
And then there are the issues Murkowski won't talk about. He refused to answer questions about the status of Alaska's Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Murkowski supports oil companies in their efforts to start drilling on the refuge, something environmentalists are vehemently opposed to. Nor would Murkowski discuss his approval of continued logging in Alaska's Tongass Forest or his support for the sale of Alaskan oil in other countries. Environmentalists will have to wait until Murkowski introduces legislation to know what his plan of action is on these issues. For the Environment Show, I'm Nancy Marshall in Washington.
We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about vegetarianism and the environment. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests are Howard Lyman. He's a fourth-generation cattle rancher turned strict vegetarian and director of the Humane Society's Eating with Conscience campaign. He's in California. Also with us is Dr. Michael Clapper, a physician and author who works to educate health professionals about the key role foods play in enhancing health. He's committed to reducing diet-related environmental degradation, and he's based in Hawaii. And with us also is Dennis Avery. He's from the Center for Global Food Issues. That's an organization which follows changes taking place in the world's ability to feed itself. He analyzes trends in food demand, agricultural productivity, and global farm competition. He's based in Virginia. Welcome, gentlemen, and Howard, let me start with you. From your perspective, is it impossible for me to be an environmentalist because I eat meat?
Oh, absolutely not. I think that there will always be meat eaters in the world. I think the question that we're looking at is, will the predominant diet in the world be meat or not? The question that we have out there right now is, can we afford a meat-based diet? For every calorie of meat that's being produced today in the factory feedlots in America today, it's estimated about 70 calories of energy are necessary to produce a calorie of meat. I think it is obvious that we are spending our children's inheritance and their future if we continue on a meat-based diet. But if we look at family farmers utilizing grass, I think that there will always be a place for meat in the diet, but at a much reduced level.
Now, Dr. Clapper, the argument, as I take it, is that if we increase our vegetable intake, we're not only improving the environment, but we're also improving our health. And yet, in the United States, vegetables are produced with tremendous amounts of pesticides and herbicides. So doesn't that take away from some of the environmental benefit of vegetarianism as we hear it espoused?
Well, I certainly share your concerns. It's been said that we're going to be known as the society that grew our food with poisons. And I'm all for growing our fruits and vegetables without the poisonous herbicides and pesticides. But when it comes to the overall degradation of the environment, the topsoil erosion, the water pollution, the water consumption, deforestation, there's no question that large-scale animal agriculture is the driving destructive force. And switching to more plant-based foods will not only make the people healthier, it will certainly make the environment more stable as well.
Now, Dennis, Dennis Avery, you follow these things. We see societies like China, which we're told that there's a tremendous increase in demand for beef and other meats, and as a result of that, the environment is going to get even worse than it is now. Is that where we're going as we look at the world in general?
Well, I sympathize with the vegetarian desire to be part of environmental improvement, and certainly vegetarians tread more lightly on the land than do people who eat lots of meat, milk, and eggs. The problem is that the world is moving more rapidly toward more high-quality protein than ever before in history. And you mentioned China. Their meat consumption increased by 5 million tons last year alone. And this is happening all over Asia. It's beginning to happen all over Latin America. Europe is already heavily into livestock-based diets. And at this point, unless there is some dramatic new effort by the vegetarian movement, then vegetarianism, instead of being part of the solution, is going to be part of the problem.
But let me ask you, Howard, you are an advocate, I guess, of the notion that we really have to cut down on our consumption of meat in order to save the planet. Is that really doable?
Oh, absolutely.
People who eat meat, and I'm one of them, really going to say we're going to give this up in order to save the world?
I wouldn't say that we're going to turn everybody into a flaming vegan, but I will tell you this. If we look at the consumption of red meat from 1976 till today, we've gone from 93 pounds to 63 pounds. We have increased fish and chicken. But what we're seeing now is people are starting to get the inkling out there of what's going on. If we take the United States, number one killer that's out there today is heart disease. Contributing factors, saturated fat and cholesterol. All cholesterol comes from animal products. The majority of saturated fat in our American diet, animal products. People are getting it.
All right, well, let's go to the phones, and we have a call from Montana. Bob, you're talking green in the Environment Show.
Hi, Peter. I'm a rancher from Montana, and like thousands of my peers across the country, I care deeply for the condition of our land, and then listen to our speakers, Dr. Clapper and Mr. Lemon. I object somewhat, I guess, when they refer to the grasslands. You know, out here, not only was our West one on a high-protein red meat diet, rich in vitamins and minerals, but also most of America also. Here in Montana, as I suppose rest of America, I look at it as a win-win situation out here. We use our livestock to manage our grasslands and at the same time enhancing our natural resources. I guess on our ranch, by developing water on some of our uplands and our pasture rotation systems, we have enhanced our riparian areas, and at the same time, we have increased our wildlife numbers. We've increased the numbers of our deer and our elk and our turkeys and beavers and grouse and all the other small wildlife greatly by managing our resource. You know,
well,
history
Bob,
is
Bob,
ongoing.
Let me turn this around for a moment.
Okay.
If the world becomes vegetarian, if this country gets out of the meat-eating business, what happens to your ranch?
I don't think we're ever going to go out of business. Meat is a luxury item, so to speak, I guess. We're finding more and more people demanding a higher and higher quality beef, and us as ranchers, we're producing that. Meat is now leaner than it ever has been and probably safer than it ever has been in its entire history.
Okay, well, thanks for your comment and call. And let me ask you, Dr. Klepper, what I think the caller is saying is that we can enjoy the meat diet and still be healthy. Is he right about that?
Well, there's no question. When you look around the world, as countries add more and more meat to the diet, the same health trends develop. They get fatter, their cholesterol levels go up, their arteries clog, their heart attack rate goes up, the cancer rate goes up. Just because people like to eat more meat, it doesn't mean that it's healthy. You can get a taste for liking alcohol, for cigarettes. That's human nature, but it doesn't mean that it's healthy. Clearly, the trends in medical studies show that the less meat we eat, the more plant-based foods we eat, the healthier we're going to be. The Chinese and all those folks eating more and more meat are going to repeat the same Western health disasters that we've seen in the States. I think a plant-based diet is definitely the healthier diet for the future.
Okay, well, let's take another call. This time we'll go to California and speak with Pamela. Pamela, you're on the Environment Show.
Hi. Well, I work with a bakery company here in L.A. that's just totally vegetarian, actually vegan baked goods. And the increase in our business has been astronomical. And I want to say that I see a huge trend toward people wanting vegetarian foods. And it's not only people who call themselves or are vegetarians or vegans. It is people who want to reduce their meat consumption and their animal product consumption for health reasons, for, you know, if they want to keep their cholesterol down, their fat content down. In fact, I'm friends with companies that are doing the similar products. For instance, the Garden Burger Company, they have increased their production level 100% per year for the past 3 years.
You're saying this stuff is good business. Is that basically it?
Demand is there. People are realizing that it's smart to, if not full-time, at least part-time, eat plant-based foods for their health, for the environment, and for ethical reasons.
Okay. Well, thanks for your comment. And
I just want to say that, let's not overlook, there's been a concerted effort to encourage meat eating, for everything from the USDA government policies, the very powerful meat industry, the meat lobby. Everything has been done to promote meat consumption, and a noticeable anti-vegetarian tone from everything from the media to government policies. And to blame the vegetarians as being ineffective, I think, is really unfair.
What I'm saying is that there is a very fundamental human hunger for high-quality protein. There's not even any advertising in China, and yet their meat consumption is increasing 10% a year.
Well, let me ask you, Dennis.
So is their cigarette consumption. So is their alcohol consumption.
All right, hold on.
It doesn't mean it's healthy.
Dennis Avery, I want to ask a question of you. What you're saying is that this trend toward vegetarianism simply doesn't happen. How does one feed the globe, given a doubling of our world population in the next 50 years or so, under the existing scheme of things, based on what the vegetarian folk are saying about the need for so much more grain to produce a pound of meat than if you simply eat the grain directly?
We've been far more successful at raising the yields on our crops and livestock and increasing the productivity of the farms than we have been at creating vegetarians. And here we have the vegetarians telling us to go to low-yield organic farming. And that aggravates the problem.
It's foolish economics and foolish ecology, and we are spending our topsoil and our water for an orgy of meat eating, and the time is running out on us, and we cannot sustain this. This is simply non-sustainable.
Well, as an agriculturist, Dr. Clapper, I can tell you that we're doing better on soil erosion than we've ever done.
It's still pouring into the rivers far faster.
Let me interrupt you both for a moment. Mm-hmm. Our farm is in New England, and we grow sheep. Now, we grow sheep on land that would be totally unsuitable for grains, in places where you don't have the environmental degradation or the waste that occurs when you feed grain at a high ratio. Your sense is that even in those places, it's better to put the land into some other use than putting it into growing protein.
Absolutely. Somehow we think that just because the land isn't producing meat protein, it's of no value. But you could use that land to grow forests, to grow fiber crops, to grow biomass. There's so much else you could do with that land. We've got to get out of this old thought pattern.
Okay. Well, we've been discussing vegetarianism and the environment. And my guests have been Howard Lyman from the Humane Society, Dr. Michael Clapper, a physician based in Hawaii, and Dennis Avery from the Center of Global Food Issues. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. You're Talking Green on the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Roderick Nash is a professor of history and environmental studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. He's a descendant of the legendary river explorer Simon Roderick Fraser and has rowed more than 40,000 river miles, including over 50 descents of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. He presents a portrait of lava falls on the Colorado River found in his book The Big Drops, 10 Legendary Rapids of the American West, published by Johnson Books.
You never really finish running Lava Falls. Asked on the river the night before Lava if he was ready for the rapid, one Grand Canyon boatman said he hoped so because he had run it 400 times that winter, driving to work every morning and before sleeping every night. Few rapids in the world grip the mind that way. Few have the ability to condense a year, a lifetime on moving water into 45 pounding seconds. Lava Falls does. It is an indisputed big drop. Season after season, high water and low, kayaks to pontoons, lava has a strong claim to being the most challenging stretch of whitewater in the American West. Lava waits at mile 179.2, about two-thirds of the way through the Grand Canyon. A prehistoric lava dam once blocked the Colorado here, but the modern rapid is as much a product of side canyon debris flow. The falls drop 37 feet in a few hundred yards. This means that at river level, back in your boat after scouting, all you see is a horizontal line, the distant canyon wall, and occasional bursts of spray jetting up in between. The acceleration on the rapid's tongue is astonishing. If you are set up in the wrong place, there is no time for correction. Even on a good run, you claw up 15 to 20-foot standing waves. Passengers keep low profiles and grip the ropes or gunnels. Boatmen with only oars in their hands are regularly washed into the seething river. It is hard to remember much about the end of a run of Lava Falls. There are the diminishing tail waves, the overpowering sense of relief, the hugs and shouts. In the exultation of the moment, it is tempting to think that you have conquered the rapid. Old hands know better. You never really triumph over natural forces. The river, in this case, just let you through. As you sit on the beach, river right, below lava, you look back upstream at the moving white staircase and think, gratefully, one more time.
Professor Roderick Nash, reading from his book, The Big Drops, 10 Legendary Rapids of the American West, published by Johnson Books. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. At this moment, in the Caribbean Ocean just off the coast of Panama, some forms of algae or seaweed are engaged in process of reproduction. About the only way to describe it is seaweed sex. The seawater has become clear and the sun is hot. The plants vary in size. Some look like pea-sized bulbs on runners. Others are stalk-like. Still others are sea fans. Most are various shades of green. Kenneth Clifton speaks to us from the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama, where he's with the University of California Santa Cruz research affiliate. 2 years ago, he discovered the phenomenon which occurs at this time of year while swimming around a coral reef.
At 5:30 in the morning, 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning, you go out on the reef, and all of a sudden you'll notice the water taking on sort of a greenish cast and the visibility starting to plummet. And if you swim upstream of these green clouds, you'll find that hundreds or sometimes thousands of green algae are releasing their eggs and sperm basically into the water column and producing these copious clouds of gunk that then sort of drift around for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then that's all over and gone. And then maybe another 20 minutes later, another species may go off, or several species may go off at the same time.
Clifton says these seaweeds are integral to the reef community, and while they are plants, they have sexual characteristics that resemble animals.
They are definitely plants, but they act very much like animals in their sexual reproduction. What they're doing is basically on a very synchronous schedule, suddenly within seconds of each other all over the reef, releasing their gametes up into the water column. And this is something that corals and urchins and things like that do. And nobody really suspected that any group of plants were doing things like this.
Clifton marvels at how organized and tight the timing of the whole process is, which results in the end of the life of the plant.
When they're doing this, they're migrating their entire cell contents from the base and the body of the plant to these specialized structures that develop on the outside of the plant. And it's from these that the gametes are released. And as soon as the gametes are released in this 10 or 15-minute pulse of reproduction, the plant's dead. And so I don't know if I've gotten a sense to you across of just how amazingly sort of organized and tight this timing is from this plant just sitting there on the reef doing the same thing it's been doing day after day after day, and suddenly it and a number of others on the reef suddenly make this transition and 36 hours later, they're all dead, but they've all reproduced.
Clifton's research tells us that even if ecological disaster brings extinction to both birds and bees, parents will still be able to use examples in nature to teach their children the facts of life. Instead of birds and bees, they can talk about seaweed. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, have you ever wondered where your food comes from? Community-supported agriculture teams farmers with customers. The result is fresh organic food, and it's a good deal for everyone. So you're a vegetarian? Your survival may be dependent on the cow, after all. That rock-hard tomato in your supermarket isn't your only option. An organization in Iowa grows 4,000 tomatoes. They travel the world to collect seeds and preserve heirloom crops. We go to Laos and the Ho Chi Minh Trail to investigate a power dam under construction on a tributary to the Mekong River. And composer Alan Copeland celebrates the Appalachian Spring. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Food is the most important product we take from the environment. Vegetables, meat, and dairy products are produced from the earth's soil, air, and water. So keeping the environment healthy goes hand in hand with good food. One of the ways to keep the environment in good shape is through the choices each of us make when we buy our food. Today, a growing number of people are buying food from local farms. The consumer gets inexpensive fresh food direct from the farmer, and farmers get money to stay in business. The movement is called community-supported agriculture. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally visited one of these farms and has this report.
Americans want fresh food. Gone are the days when grocery stores specialized in white bread and canned vegetables. Today, for health and environmental reasons, people are seeking out fresh and often organic food from local farms. And from this desire, community-supported farms, or CSAs, have emerged.
Well, we wanted a closer connection from the farm and consumers. We felt that we tried to forge a closer connection. And the CSA does that. It's a direct link between the consumers and the producers.
Tom Myers is the garden manager at Hawthorne Valley Farm in Ghent, New York. The farm sells shares to about 200 families. They pay $450 in the spring and get a weekly allotment of the harvest of vegetables. Members pick their food up from a central location. The idea is to supply local organic produce to members while keeping the farm in business. That's especially important to farms like Hawthorne Valley. It lies in a quiet stretch of rolling hills in far eastern New York. Farms have a tough time surviving in these kinds of places where scenic land is sought after and expensive. In the main barn at Hawthorne Valley, 60 cows are busy feeding. They're lined up in two rows facing away from each other, and in between them stands Tom Myers. He says Hawthorne Valley gives people a connection between their dinner table and the farm.
A big factor right now for consumers is that they seem to want to know where the food's coming from, and they want to make a connection with the place and also with the people that are growing the food. So a CSA affords them that opportunity, whereas just buying organic produce in a store, they really have no connection. They don't know where that food's coming from. They know it may be organic, but they don't have a real connection. And I think the word the CSA is if they started in Japan, and the translation for CSA over there is farming with a face, and that's basically what CSA is all about.
Once that relationship is formed, members are encouraged to visit the farm whenever they want. Stefan Snyder is the farm manager here. He says members can tour the fields, check out the dairy where yogurt and cheese is made, or come here to the cow barn where most of the farm's fertilizer is produced.
We have a few formal days each year that we try to invite members as a group, but I mean, I think this farm is always open for visitors, and I would encourage every member to come visit anytime they want to. I mean, that's really the whole idea, that it's, you know, it all is only going to work if there's a certain amount of human relationship developed, and, you know, you can only do that if you meet each other. So definitely, yes, they should visit every all during the season, because it's different depending, you know, spring, summer, winter.
Snyder says Hawthorne Valley has 12 acres of vegetables. It also sells dairy products and bread made on the farm. He says if members are willing to be a bit flexible, they can get much of their food from the farm. But that means dealing with the fluctuations of nature. Last year, Hawthorne Valley had a bumper crop of winter squash. While they traded some of it for beets and carrots with another farm, members still got a lot of squash.
I mean, I think in terms of vegetable needs, we can supply, I would say, a large majority, especially if people are willing to eat according to the season. If they're willing to eat root crops more during the winter and don't necessarily want to have a tomato salad or melons every day in December, I think we can, on the vegetable side, we can provide quite a bit because, you know, there is storage crops that would last, well, at least into March, and then maybe there would be a short window where there wouldn't be much, but then we start up again by the end of May. So there is, I think, from that point of view, we can supply quite a bit.
But that's what being part of a CSA is all about. It's not like buying food from a supermarket. Because members essentially buy a percentage of the harvest, they share in the benefits as well as the risks with the farmer. For instance, if there's a drought, members get less food. But the CSA movement is only about 5 to 10 years old in this country, and observers say it's flexible enough to work in any region of the country or even the world. Garden manager Tom Myers says the CSA movement is expanding to appeal to a broader audience.
But I think what it will take is overcoming some of the drawbacks to CSA, such as convenience, variety. Those are the two big things. You come on a certain specified time to a certain specified place to pick up your produce for the week, and you get what's harvested. And the challenge is going to be to broaden the varieties and the choices and also the times of distribution. In other words, we're going to have to become more like a store, which there's talk in those directions yet, but I think it's just beginning now.
Myers says CSAs are one way farms here in the Northeast and elsewhere can survive. He says there's no way their corn, for instance, can compete on the wholesale market with corn from the Midwest. So what keeps Hawthorne Valley afloat and the land in production is the added value to their products which the members provide. CSAs don't sell to middlemen because they sell directly to consumers. This way farmers get more money than they would if they had sold it on the wholesale market, and consumers get a good product that would likely have been trucked in hundreds or thousands of miles if the CSA didn't exist. Lauren Bradford is the farm manager at Hawthorne Valley.
Value adding is the way that small farmers are going to stay in business because the wholesale market is not set up for a small scale.
And is CSA a version of value adding?
Oh, definitely, because you're doing the chain. You're not being a wholesaler. You're getting directly to the consumer, so you're dealing with each step in the chain.
Today's CSAs are found mostly on the East and West Coast and in Wisconsin. But the movement is spreading. If you'd like more information, call the Biodynamics Association at 1-800-516-7797. That's 1-800-516-7797. Contact Community Supported Agriculture of North America at csana@bcn.net. On the World Wide Web, search under Community Supported Agriculture. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Most debates between vegetarians and people who eat meat, including the one aired earlier on this program, wind up with a discussion of the cow. For the vegetarian, the bovine is an inefficient beast which eats grain that could better be fed to humans.
She causes people to destroy rainforests for pasture and then destroys grasslands through overgrazing. The human carnivore savors beef and argues that properly managed, the cow can make edible meat from grass that humans can't eat. It may well be, however, that the vegetarian needs the cow for reasons that have nothing to do with hamburger or steak. We examine an attribute of the cow which may ensure that even vegetarians can't do without her. Garden manager Tom Myers from Hawthorne Valley Farm in Ghent, New York, explains why he has 60 cows helping him grow vegetables.
Well, from a biodynamic point of view, the cow produces the best potential fertilizer. The manure from the cow produces the best compost. So the cow is essential on a biodynamic farm. And we have about 60 cows here, and that makes about the amount of compost that we need to do both the vegetables and the field crops.
Farm manager Stefan Snyder says the productive capacity of the cow is not always understood by customers and visitors to the farm.
The question about the animal, I think, is extremely interesting because we run into it all the time with apprentices, for example, you know, that come here and sort of have the question about the animals, and with customers, with consumers. And I think I think it's a very hard question, but one little example is, for example, last year we had a person who was very strictly vegetarian, and after being on the farm for a while and she could see how everything fits together, she loosened up her attitude and actually I think that's not Lauren either, and I think she started being more flexible. Did she even eat meat, Jody? I think she ate. I think she was even willing to eat some meat. So I think what's happened today is people are so disconnected from where their food comes from, that they have really, and you know, you can't blame them for that, they have no concept or perception of what's needed. So if you want to look at sustainable food production, it's not, for me, it's not thinkable without animals. And since the cow is, you know, even a very special animal, being a ruminant, there's no other animal out there that we can use agriculturally and that can use all that grass that's out there. You know, the cow can use grass, digest it, and then do all kinds of things with it. Least of it not being is the manure. You know, that's really what we're after. There have been long-range experiments done in Britain, for example, where they've compared plots, where they've used cow manure compost, other compost, and it's, I think, proven beyond doubt that the cow manure is the most balanced base, and it actually fits as a picture. You know, it's the most balanced manure to grow plants, so it's like you're almost made for each other. So from that point of view, and I think it's, for me, it's really the only option.
And so, even in this day of heightened rhetoric from the advertising community, the media, and politicians, there is no substitute for the genuine product. It's the cow that produces the real thing. Vegetarians, take note. In many cultures, seeds for crops are family treasures passed from generation to generation. But as modern agriculture spreads to the far reaches of the earth, many of these crops are disappearing. Yet the heirloom varieties are critical for maintaining genetic diversity. Time and time again, we've learned that reliance on only a few varieties of crops leaves us vulnerable to catastrophic blights and infestations. An organization called Seed Savers, based in Decorah, Iowa, maintains heirloom plant varieties using the army of backyard gardeners around the world. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally spoke with Kent Wheely. He's the executive director of Seed Savers, and he talked about his organization's mission and their recent efforts to preserve seeds from Eastern Europe.
We have also put together a collection of seeds that is being maintained or permanently maintained at our headquarters, which is a 170-acre farm here in northeast Iowa. And that collection now numbers about 18,000 varieties of rare vegetables and fruits. And the collections have really gotten huge. I mean, we're maintaining a collection of 4,000 different tomatoes. And it was getting to the point where everything that was coming into our collections we had already seen. But within the last few years, since 1991, I've been doing a lot of work in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And we've been funding collecting expeditions over there. And when that material started flowing into our collections, it is different than anything that we have ever seen. I mean, we're seeing black tomatoes from Russia. We're seeing tomatoes that have foliage like a carrot top. Just things that are just unbelievable to us. Seed Savers has been really highly successful at collecting North American heirlooms. But there are regions in the world that are much richer genetically. When you get into areas of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, especially really rugged areas that where the farms could never be collectivized, traditional agriculture goes all the way back to the beginning with all of the seeds still produced by gardeners and farmers. And in areas over there that are sort of wet, warm mountain regions, especially the Caucasus and the Transylvanian Alps and different areas like that, the genetic diversity in those areas is just dazzling. But what's happening right now is that Western agricultural technology is flooding into these areas very rapidly, along with improved, if you will, American and Japanese and Dutch seeds. And the genetic richness in those areas is probably going to be lost within about 10 years.
And as far as what is the impetus behind saving these varieties?
I mean, saving those varieties?
Yeah, I mean, you know what, you know, and I'm asking this question, uh-huh. you know, kind of knowing the response. But what is you know, what is the need to keep these? I mean, if these seeds are the modern seeds, the so-called modern seeds are so-called improved, then you know, in some people's minds, they'll think, well, you know, of course we should replace these seeds. These are relics from the past, and, you know, why do we need to keep them around other than, you know, someone's, you know, back project in their backyard?
Yeah. All of our major crops are constantly being challenged by pests and diseases. And you need to think of it as a genetic race, if you would, with the crops on with the food crops on the one hand and the diseases and the pests on the other. And scientists need these relic crops to breed increased disease resistances into modern crops. And without those infusions of genetic diversity, food production worldwide is at risk. And this is all of the genetic material that we're ever going to have to accomplish that, I mean, adding those types of resistances. And what we're seeing right now is that on every hand, this breeding material is dying out at an incredibly rapid rate.
Now, of course, the geneticists, or at least the gene jockeys, the so-called gene jockeys, will say, you know, that they can handle anything really that comes down the pike. You know, they will be able to create the seeds or plants that have resistances and that can take on the attributes that of the attributes that are found in these plants.
Well, I've certainly heard all of those arguments, and the thing that frightens me, I guess, is that the gene jockeys, if you will, really believe that. I mean, I've heard the argument made that if the Great Barrier Reef were completely destroyed, we now have the technology to recreate it. And that is so patently absurd. I mean, when you think of the cost of these techniques, much less the time that it would take, and our incomplete knowledge of what was there in the first place, I mean, it's absolutely absurd. We reassemble, but we don't create. And even to reassemble, you have to have the basic building blocks. And all of it exists. I mean, all that we have to do is just keep it alive right now.
Kent Wheely is the executive director of Seed Savers, based in Decorah, Iowa. You can reach him by phone at 319-382-5990. That's 319-382-5990. The Environment Show wants to hear from you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind or send us questions you have about the environment. You can visit us on the internet where you can hear The Environment Show anytime. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. Or call our toll-free number. It's 1-888-49-GREEN. We continue our look at biodiversity around the world in another conversation with Lee Talbot, senior professor in the Program of Environmental Science and Public Policy at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. This time, he reports on his recent trip to Laos, where he inspected a dam project on the Nam Thung River, which is a tributary to the Mekong. He was there as an environmental consultant to the World Bank, which is financing the dam for a private consortium. You've heard Lee Talbot previously in The Environment Show with reports from China and Bhutan. Some of us had a chance to see that country 30 years ago, since the area you describe was also traversed by the Ho Chi Minh Trail. What does it look like today?
Well, the plateau itself has been considerably affected, modified by human activity. Part of it had to do with what you're describing, because when you fly over or even walk over it, you still see a lot of bomb craters. And indeed, in virtually every one of the villages I visited, the casings of 500-pound bombs were being used either to help hold up the houses as stilts, or split open and being used as essentially flower boxes or vegetable gardens raised out of the way of the chickens, which pick and eat everything on the ground.
I like the idea that maybe after the bloodshed, flower boxes are the fruits of war. But is this area pretty heavily wooded still or not?
The area that's going to be inundated is no longer heavily wooded. When I was in Laos first in 1955, I never got to this area because it was regarded as being far too isolated. It was spoken of with a bit of awe by the French then and the Laotians. It had been a royal hunting ground and was famous for the elephants, gaur, another big game that was on it. However, now, virtually the whole plateau has been very modified. Much of it has been cut for shifting cultivation, a little bit of permanent cultivation. There are villages scattered throughout, and the area has been and is being logged extensively, partly as a salvage logging to get particularly the pine trees out before the area is inundated. It's also been very, very heavily hunted, so that hearing birds is a rare thing. We traveled around by dugout canoe quite a bit, hiked quite a bit, flew over it by helicopter, and drove all over by four-wheel drive vehicle. So we had a chance to have a very good look at the place. It's very different now, I believe, than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Talbot says while the dam will flood 45 square kilometers of the plateau, the plan is to protect 4,000 square kilometers of forested land above it in the Annamite Mountains, an area which he says is unique.
It has particular value because this is the area where in the past 4 years, four new species of biggish mammal have been found, along with at least one bird. This is the area where 4 years ago a new genus of ox was found. This is something wholly new to science, and the idea of finding a new genus is mind-blowing from a scientific point of view. A new species of barking deer was found there. I actually saw some of them. The fresh skulls of a thing called a warty hog were found last year, I believe, in one of the villages, and that animal has been thought to be extinct for decades. And another, a hare, has been tentatively identified, which was thought to be extinct also.
That was Lee Talbot of George Mason University speaking with us about his recent inspection trip for the World Bank to the Nam Thun Dam construction project just off the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos. It's springtime. Where I live, ice and snow still clings to the land, but we hope it'll melt soon, and the snowdrops and forsythia will appear. Already, we're seeing finches and bluebirds. Geese were high in the sky moving north a couple of weeks ago. In 1938, the American composer Aaron Copland wrote this piece, Appalachian Spring, for a ballet by Catherine Graham. The title comes from a poem by Hart Crane, which celebrates the change in seasons. This part of Appalachian Spring is called Simple Gifts, named after the Shaker folk song from which it was adapted. Simple Gifts from Aaron Copland's 1938 composition, Appalachian Spring. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 378. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.